Of all the resources needed to build an economy that will sustain economic progress, none is more scarce than time. That is one of the key messages of today's guest, Lester Brown, founder of both World Watch and the Earth Policy Institute, and the author of Plan B 3.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. Plan A, the Western, fossil fuel-based, auto-centered, throwaway economic model, is not going to work for China, or India, or the 3 billion other people in developing countries, and it will not continue to work for the industrial countries either. It's time for Plan B, an all-out response at wartime speed proportionate to the magnitude of the threats facing civilization. Lester Brown says we're in a race between tipping points in natural and political systems. Which will come first? Can we mobilize the political will to phase out coal-fired power plants before the melting of the Greenland ice sheet becomes irreversible? Can we halt deforestation in the Amazon before it so weakens the forest that it becomes vulnerable to fire and is destroyed? Can we cut carbon emissions fast enough to save the Himalayan glaciers that feed the major rivers of Asia? Plan B 3.0 is a comprehensive plan for reversing the trends that are undermining our future. Its four overriding goals: stabilize climate, stabilize population, eradicate poverty, and restore the Earth's damaged ecosystems. Failure to reach any one of these goals will likely mean failure to reach the others as well. And as I said, time is our scarcest resource, and saving civilization, Lester Brown says, is not a spectator sport. So, listeners, it's time to listen hard and make sure we're not spectators. Lester Brown has been described by the Washington Post as one of the world's most influential thinkers. After working with the Department of Agriculture and International Agricultural Development, he helped establish the Overseas Development Council. Then he founded World Watch Institute, which has for years, now going on 30 years, put out its annual State of the World report, and over the last several years also the annual Vital Signs. In 2001, he left World Watch, founded the Earth Policy Institute, published Eco-Economy, Building an Economy for the Earth. His other books include Who Will Feed China?, Environmental Trends Reshaping the Global Economy, and as I said, his newest, the one we're talking about today, Plan B 3.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. This is part two of a two-part interview. If you want to find part one, you can go to tmcnally.com and go to podcasts. Lester Brown.
Terry, it's good to be here.
Okay. As I said, in part one, we sort of talked about what's changed, why Plan B 3.0 had to happen, how things have gotten, how the situation has shifted since 2.0, and we talked about some of the problems. What I want to do for people who missed that show is just flesh out what you're trying to do in the Plan Bs.
The four big challenges we're facing right now: need to stabilize climate, stabilize population, eradicate poverty, and restore the Earth's damaged ecosystems. The reason, incidentally, for the need to eradicate poverty is that we probably cannot stabilize population growth humanely unless we can eradicate poverty. The two are tied together, so I sort of think of them as being part of the same package. Stabilizing population means educating youngsters everywhere, making sure that all youngsters get at least an elementary school education, girls as well as boys. It means providing basic health care, immunization against childhood diseases, for example, the basic fundamentals of health care at the village level. We're not talking about open heart surgery here and so forth. We're talking about just the very basics of clean water supply, for example. And we have to combine reproductive health care and family planning services as part of this. The world cannot afford unplanned pregnancies on the scale that's happening today. I mean, there are at least 200 million women in the world who want to space their children, who want to limit the number of children, but who do not have access to family planning programs. And the cost of family planning programs for these 200 million women over a year would be a fraction of what we're spending, a tiny fraction of what we're spending in Iraq today.
Right. Iraq, I believe at this point, is $2 to $3 billion a week. And I want to put a price tag on a number of the treatments that you suggest for civilization. And it's so sad how Well, basically, at 2 billion a week, in 2 years of Iraq, we could basically solve almost everything we're facing. And I mean, that's talk about misspent resources. Let me, if I may, look at this like we're treating civilization as our patient. Okay, what are and I want to I'll lay out for listeners the plan I have for this second part. Briefly, the symptoms, some of the headlines, the diagnosis, and then focus on the treatment. And when we focus on the treatment, I want to look first at some of the human things you were just talking about: poverty, education, family planning, those sorts of things, because they are so human and so cost effective. And then let's spend the latter portion of this half hour looking at energy, which seems to be the place where an awful lot of change is happening. So just for anyone who's been in a cave or missed the first half, what are some of the symptoms?
When we look at the things we need to do, whether it's dealing with population growth and the consequences of that, whether it's climate change and the fallout from that, which are becoming enormous threats. I mean, ice melting and rising sea levels pose a threat unlike any that civilizations ever faced before. I mean, when you think that the Greenland ice sheet alone, if it were to go, would raise sea level 23 feet. I mean, think about the world's coastlines.
Yes, one of the things I love that Al Gore actually points out, an inconvenient truth, is that that area of Manhattan that is now hallowed ground because of the 9/11 attack, that would go underwater.
It would indeed. Much of Wall Street would be underwater, in fact. So these are not trivial issues or the product of someone's imagination. These are things that are going to happen if we stay with Plan A. And so we look at Plan B: stabilize climate, stabilize population, eradicate poverty, and rebuild the Earth-damaged ecosystems. The total bill for all that in terms of annual expenditures is less than $200 billion a year. I actually call it the new defense bill, because the real threats to our future now are not other superpowers, or not even terrorism, though it's obviously a problem and something we have to deal with. The big threats to our future are climate change, continuing rapid population growth, a continuing destruction of the economy's environmental support systems, things that lead to failing states. And if I were to pick one indicator that's going to tell us more about our future than anything else now, it would be the number of failing states in the world. That list is getting longer year by year, and it raises a disturbing question, which is, how many failing states before we have a failing global civilization?
And let me ask you, Thomas Barnett, are you familiar with his work or not?
I've seen his name, but
Well, then I was going to ask you about him. Instead, I'll just recommend him to you, and that you guys should talk. He's also in Washington. He is a defense planner who has looked at the big picture and talks about the same thing. He says he's coming at it from defense, from war, from all of that analysis. He says the key threat is failing states. And he points to, you know, he says, for instance, and I'm just going to put this out there for people, that the way that the U.S. thinks of its military right now is wrongheaded, in that it thinks about it as an attack force. He says that in this era where the biggest threats to civilization come from failed states, that it has so much more to be an education arm, a reconstruction arm, a rebuilding arm. And so it's just, I think you two would have a very interesting cross-pollination. And
it's interesting, coming from very different vantage points, we arrive at the same place.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's what I think. That's what I saw about Plan B 3.0 as soon as I picked it up. That, and I said this in the earlier program we did, that a few years ago in the earlier ones, it was like, you know, we mustn't focus too much on terrorism and lose the environmental battle. But what you're saying now is they are the same battle. And I think some people have to think about that, that I've always said that the key that would minimize terrorism is when terrorists are pariahs in their own countries, because they do not meet the aspirations of the people in their country, then it's a threat, but it's a much smaller threat. And everything, it seems to me, you're talking about, which people would pick up in the environment section of the bookstore, is actually about creating supports for the majority of the populations in these states so that terrorists would end up being pariahs.
Exactly. I mean, I can remember the post-World War II period and what we did then. I mean, normally after you win a war, you know, you pillage and, you know. And we launched the Marshall Plan to rebuild the very countries with which we'd been engaged in one of the most deadly wars in history.
Yeah, I mean, the opposite of what we did after World War I.
Yes.
And we know the result of what we did after World War I was World War II. So this is the way all of this comes together. We've talked about some of the symptoms, and I just wanted to go through some more. You talked about climate change, but we've got peak oil. Mm-hmm. We've got loss of water. We've got we're losing water and we're losing soil. Just speak to that a little bit, and then we'll go to the solution.
What we have in the world today, as I see it, looking at the world through an ecological lens, if you will, is a mounting backlog of unresolved problems, many of them associated with population growth, including deforestation, expanding desert, deteriorating grasslands, eroding soils, falling water tables. Very few of these trends have been turned around, and they're getting worse and worse and becoming more difficult for governments to deal with, to cope with, to manage. And so and now we have, in addition to that, we have climate change with all the fallout from that. We have the prospect of peak oil, which may be here now. If not, it's not far into the future.
And for those of you who have heard the term but don't know what it means, peak oil is the moment at which we've taken half of the oil out of the earth. And you say, well, gee, only half? You know, we're in good shape. The problem is that at the point at which we reach peak oil, we will have taken out the easy, the cheaper, the low-hanging fruit of what's in the earth. It gets more expensive every barrel from more expensive to impossible from here on out.
Once we hit peak oil, then it's downhill in the sense that the amount of oil available will no longer be increasing. We have spent our lifetimes in a world where oil production has always been increasing, except for occasional blip here and there. But in a world where oil production is no longer increasing, no country can get more oil unless another gets less. And that's a very different world. And it creates a lot of tensions. It creates a politics of scarcity, and it creates rising oil prices. In addition to rising oil prices as a result of peak oil, we also have rising food prices in the world. Grain prices have been hitting record highs, soybean prices hitting record highs, all-time highs in recent weeks. And the reason for that, the principal reason for that, is that the United States is shifting an ever larger share of its grain harvest into the production of fuel for cars. And what that is doing is driving up world grain and soybean prices and world food prices. The world is now facing the worst food price inflation quite possibly in history.
And this is really the key to why that's so, isn't it? I mean, there are other factors, but I remember when we did the first interview on Plan B, which is probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, you mentioned this. Look for a battle mm-hmm. between when we look at grain, whether it's going to go in the gas tank of a rich person or the mouth of a poor person. And you said that then, and now it's come to fruition where oil is at an all-time high and grain is now following oil and thus grain prices at an all-time high. One point that I think is worth mentioning also is that statistic of how much grain production we have shifted to ethanol and how little of our transportation fuel it covers.
Nearly 20% of the 2007 grain harvest will be used to produce ethanol fuel for cars, and it will satisfy at most 4% of our automotive fuel needs. From an agricultural point of view, the automotive fuel demand is insatiable. I mean, the grain required to fill a 25-gallon SUV tank with ethanol will feed one person for a year.
I really want you to hear that. The grain that it will take to fill a tank of an SUV could feed a person for a year.
Yes.
And this is like you fill up, you know, once a week,
right,
a couple of times a week.
Right.
It shows the incredible blind spots and the disconnects going on that if people knew that all that grain that we're shifting is sending up grain prices for us, for the rest of the world, and leading some people to starvation, while it is handling a speck of our energy demand, it would be seen as a wrong path to go. And instead, it's been heralded by very many, although the shine is sort of off the rose right now, but as a sound environmental policy.
We're in an ironic situation, Terry, where as taxpayers, we are subsidizing the conversion of grain into ethanol and therefore a rise in our own food prices. So we get to pay twice. We get to pay on April 15th when we settle our taxes, and then once every week when we go by the supermarket checkout counter.
Yeah. And by the way, on the recent farm bill, which I did two or three shows on trying to sort of move it in the right direction, you know, with sending listeners to their congressmen and so on, not much changed. Ethanol got a great deal from that farm bill. And it just shows that once lobbyists are entrenched, they're entrenched. And it takes an awful lot to shake them. Let me shift, if we could, to solutions. Mm-hmm. And we talked in the previous hour about some of the solutions of the previous half hour and some of the solutions in terms of eradicating poverty, family planning, education, and so on. And as you pointed out, the costs of those things are minor. And I find the thing I always contrast it with is the war in Iraq, an unnecessary, illegal, and obscene war that has only made us more insecure and yet is costing us $2 to $3 billion a week. And as you say, for $200 billion a year, we could basically solve all the problems we're talking about here?
Yes.
Okay.
The key to using this almost $200 billion a year to solve these problems. I mean, the thing that's so interesting about this is one-fifth of global military expenditures, which are now over $1 trillion, which is $1,000 billion per year. So we're not talking about a huge sum. But what we are talking about is dealing with the real threats to our future, like continuing rapid population growth in low-income countries, like climate change, like the destruction of the economy's environmental support systems. These are the real threats to our future. This budget is the real defense budget.
That's right.
Because it's responding to the real threats. This building $100 billion weapons systems is almost useless now. You can't use these military systems in dealing with the problems
the real threats to our civilization. And the Bush administration has put forward a budget that has the greatest amount allotted for defense ever. So we've got about 8 more minutes. What are – I mean, if anyone has not slit their wrists yet and they're still listening, what are the solutions?
Well, in looking at climate change, we don't have to go beyond ice melting and the effects of the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet melting and the rise in sea level that would generate, or the melting of the glaciers in the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau that feed the major rivers of Asia, to see that we're in real trouble on this front. So we have devised, as part of Plan B 3.0, a plan to cut carbon emissions 80% not by 2050, which is what politicians like to talk about, but by 2020. That is over the next dozen years.
80% reduction by 2020.
Yes.
Huge challenge you've just laid out, 80% reduction in greenhouse gases, right, mm-hmm, by 2020. How do we do it?
Three things. There are three components of the plan. One is dramatically raise and systematically raise the efficiency of the world energy economy. The second is a massive investment in renewable sources of energy. And the third is increasing the earth tree cover, planting billions and billions of trees in the years ahead. On efficiency, let me just take one simple example that most people are familiar with, which is if in our lighting system we replace the old-fashioned incandescent bulbs with compact fluorescence, we can cut global electricity use 12%. That means we can close, out of the 2,360 coal-fired power plants in the world, we can close 700 of them just from gains.
So let me lay that out. Mm-hmm. If every incandescent bulb is replaced by a compact fluorescent, we close 700, which is basically one out of three almost coal power plants in the world.
Yes.
And when coal power plants, that's where greenhouse gases are just pumped up.
Right.
Okay, so that's in lighting.
40% of the world's electricity comes from coal, just to keep that in mind. I mean, we could talk about appliance efficiency, we can talk about buildings, we can talk about transportation, and I'll come back to transportation in a minute. But I want to talk about renewable sources of energy and what's happening here. Some extraordinarily exciting things. We see wind emerging as the centerpiece of the new energy economy. And by 2020, we see wind providing 40% of the world's electricity.
Where now it's coal. By when? By 2020?
Yes.
So we're talking in a dozen years, you see that ratio shifting, wind becoming the predominant versus coal.
Yes. And that means building about 1.5 million wind turbines, 2 megawatts each, 3 million megawatts of world wind generating capacity. That's a lot of wind turbines. There are about 100,000 in operation in the world today. But 1.5 million wind turbines over a dozen years is really peanuts compared with producing 65 million cars a year, which is what we're doing now. So we can do it. And we're beginning to see some big-time thinking emerge in the renewable energy front. One of my favorite examples is what Governor Rick Perry, Republican governor of Texas, and the state legislature are doing, putting together a package to harness the extraordinary abundance of wind energy in Texas. It's one of our most wind-rich states. I think it ranks third after North Dakota and Kansas. But they're planning to develop 23,000 megawatts of wind-generating capacity in the years ahead. And, I mean, think 23 coal-fired power plants. This is big-time thinking. This is no longer marginal incremental thinking. This is really going – those 23,000 megawatts of wind farms would supply half the residential electricity of Texas.
Okay.
So it's
and that's not by 20. Is that how quickly is that? That's by 2020?
That's going to be before 2020.
Before 2020.
Yeah, they're
okay.
Moving very fast. I cite that example. If we are building wind farms around the world, and installing 1.5 million wind turbines, then we're going to be in a position where if we combine that technology with plug-in hybrids, take a Toyota Prius, for example, add a second storage battery and a plug so you can recharge the batteries at night.
And they say they'll have that by 2010, and they're in competition with other companies who say they have it quicker.
The big competition right now is between Toyota with a modified Prius plug-in hybrid and GM with its Chevrolet Volt.
Right.
And the great thing about that is that, one, the batteries in the cars become a storage facility for wind energy. Remember, a hybrid car, you have a tank of gasoline as a backup when you need it. And the other thing is that the gasoline equivalent cost of running cars on cheap wind-generated electricity is less than $1 a gallon.
Wow.
What are we waiting for?
Really?
Yeah.
And will it take, when you say a number like that, I was going to ask, will it take some sort of playing with tax subsidies or incentives or anything to get us to gear up on wind and renewables?
The key is to get the market to tell the environmental truth. And right now, the market does not do that. The market does a lot of things well, but it does not do a good job of incorporating what we call the indirect cost, or what economists like to call the externalities. If we incorporate the cost of climate change in the price of fossil fuels, and the simple way to do that, of course, is simply to lower income taxes and offset that with a rise in the carbon tax. So we're not changing tax levels.
That's right. A tax neutral, so that your pocketbook a bite is the same at the end of the year. But instead of taxing labor, work, which we want more of. We tax pollution and greenhouse gases, which we want less of.
Exactly. So we end up with more jobs and less climate disruption. It's a win-win situation.
Okay, let me jump, since I only have time for one more question, believe it or not. You make the analogy that I think is worth reminding people, and I'll give you about a minute to do so, with World War II, which lived through, right?
I can remember World War II. I mean, Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. January 6, 1942, 1 month later, President Roosevelt, State of the Union address, that we're going to produce 25,000 tanks, 60,000 planes, 20,000 artillery guns. I mean, it was extraordinary. No one had ever seen arms production numbers like this. But what Roosevelt and his colleagues realized was that at that time, the largest concentration of industrial power in the world was in the U.S. automobile industry. So he called in the leaders of the industry and said, guys, guess what? We're going to ban the sale of private automobiles in the United States. And so the automobile industry had no choice but to switch to producing arms. And the exciting thing is we didn't produce just 60,000 planes, which was the goal. We produced 229,000 planes. I mean, even today, it's difficult to imagine that. We exceeded every one of those arms production goals.
So is it your sense, realistically, that that same kind of a shift on a dime could be made if the country and the leaders and the world took this seriously?
No question. It didn't take decades to restructure the U.S. industrial economy. It didn't take years. We did it in a matter of months. That's the exciting thing, the encouraging thing about what we're challenged with now. It is entirely doable. We can restructure the world energy economy and then avoid disastrous climate change if we can get our act together.
Okay, and that's just one of the many things that you can learn in Plan B 3.0, mobilizing to save civilization. That's why I went to that last question. It's about the mobilizing. And that book is available in bookstores. It's available online. It is available for a free download at earthpolicy.org. That's the website. That's the book. This was part two of a two-part interview. Part two will... and part one aired, but is available. You can go to tmcnally.com to hear it. Email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, or go to my website, tmcnally.com. You can sign up for a weekly email that you'll get that'll tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, or engage with me in any way you want. You can also get the podcast not only of the previous interview with Lester Brown, but of all my interviews at that website. Thank you, Lester Brown. Keep up the good work.
Terry, thank you very much for a great interview.
Okay, thank you.